On today's episode of the Hot Nerd Podcast, we've got an awesome conversation for you with the one, the only, the amazing, the great and powerful Clive Lloyd. I think Clive is the most reoccurring guest on this show, and I don't think that's by accident. So let's just jump right in here and let's go. Welcome to another episode of the Hop Nerd Podcast. I am your host, Sam Goodman, the Hop Nerd LLC. Make sure you head over to the website, www.thehopnerd.com, for fundamentals, learning teams, support, and so much more. Send us an email, thehopnerd@gmail.com, and be sure to follow along with us on all things social media at thehopnerd or at Sam Goodman. Welcome to today's episode. Everybody, Sam Goodman, the Hop Nerd Podcast, the Hop Nerd LLC. I am here. I am home. Wait for it. You ready? I'm cold brewed up and zened up and ready to bring you another episode of the Hop Nerd Podcast. And as you know from the introduction, we are joined today by my near and dear friend, the amazing, the awesome, someone that I admire in many, many ways, the awesome Clive Lloyd. So I'm not going to say a bunch. We're going to get right into this thing as quickly as possible, but I do have to remind you, head over to www.thehopnerd.com. Follow along on all things that you can follow along on. Instagram is where you find most of the not safety related things. So if you want to go follow me there, that is just at thehopnerd. LinkedIn is where you can find probably the most information, and that is probably where I post the most. I postest the mostest on LinkedIn, and that's just at Sam. It's at Sam Goodman. You can find my ugly mug. And make sure you follow along with the Hop Nerd. We have several different pages over there on LinkedIn in particular. So for the Hop Nerd LLC, for 10 ideas to make safety suck less. If you're a fan of the book, make sure that you're following there. And if you haven't read the book, make sure you go check that book out. 10 ideas to make safety suck less. You can find the whole series of kind of that suck title on Amazon. So if you want to go check those out, all the way back to the original Safety Sucks, it's still out there. You can still get copies of it, to Safety Sucks the Manifesto, which was a bit of an expansion and that I wrote with my near and dear friend Ian Allison. Safety Sucks the Manifesto, really building off of the original Safety Sucks book and some ideas and some thoughts. It was just cool to get to write that with my near and dear friend. And then obviously the most recent 10 ideas to make safety suck less, which is a focus on operationalizing human and organizational performance. These 10 key ideas that I know that I discovered as we were doing this internal to organizations. It's a really great practical little book that gives you intros and all kinds of stuff like actionable things pre and post chapter. And it's just cool. I've got so much love from you guys on that book in particular. You guys have seemed to eat it up since it was released about a year and a half ago, something like that. It's been out in the world for definitely over a year, I think just under two. But yeah, make sure you check all that stuff out. And obviously, Operationally Curious Questions, you can get those over in the merch shop. If you've not seen those are slick. And leaders in particular seem to really, really appreciate those. It's a card deck that just gives you some really great starting points for operations. Curious conversations. I stumble across these as I spend time out in the world helping you guys on your hop journey and your journey towards just humanizing our approaches overall to safety and everything else in between. I stumble across those with people using those in their team meetings. I stumble across those with leaders just saying, hey, I'm not sure where to start with these conversations in the field, and I don't want to use that crappy observation sheet. I got to do it. I got to fill it in because we've got like a metric and you measure me on it. I got to do it. Yeah, like you count them and then I get in trouble if I don't. I'll fill that in later. But they're pulling a card out of that deck and they're going, huh, I'm going to go talk to people about this. It's exactly that. That's why we called them starting points. Yeah. Hold on. Let me rewind. I'm getting out of the we thing into the I thing because it is just me here. That's why I called them starting points. And maybe in the future, we'll look at some additions to that. Like, I don't know, with cards, I guess you'd call that an expansion pack. Does that sound about right? Yeah. But you'll find those, a link to those over in the merch shop. So if you go to thehopnerd.com, you just click shop. There you go. You'll see it. It should be at the very, very top, and it'll take you over to a page that you can order those from. They're a little high because I didn't realize that printing playing cards on demand cost so freaking much money. But it does. It does. And I'm sorry. If you see that they cost $20, that means I get about a nickel out of it. But they're useful. So we keep them out there and people, there's thousands. I was really surprised with just how quickly people put those to use in their organizations. We sold thousands upon thousands upon thousands of those decks. And that's because they're freaking cool. I use them in workshops. I use them and myself out in the field a bit. It's just a great little tool. So check those out. And then if you scroll on down, you'll see all those super duper slick merch designs that we've been working with artists on to create some that we've created. Well, it is kind of a week because Avery helps a bunch with that too, that we've created. But then also with like actual like legit artists that have created really, 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 really stinking cool merch that does not look like safety crap, that does not look like corporate-y crap, that I think really captures a bit of the essence. There we go. The soul of the Hop Nerd podcast. So make sure you check out all that stuff. If you're super duper interested in everything that we've got going on, you can scroll down to the bottom of just about any page on the Hop Nerd website and just click join the mailing list. And that will give you access to everything that I've got going on, where I'm at currently in this great, big, awesome, mostly awesome world. Yeah, because I post that. So if you're looking for hop meetups or you want to tell me where to get the best coffee or anything like that, that mailing list is about the right move for you, I think. Now, the last thing that I really want to share with you here, after, you know, plugging all the stuff that obviously we have to plug, the stuff that helps us keep the lights on around here, I have an awesome workshop coming up. And you've probably seen this. If you've not, I would be surprised because I've been pushing out a bunch of really, I think, are hilarious photoshops of me and the amazing Steve Scott. Yeah, if you haven't seen them, go over to LinkedIn and just browse through my posts. Just, you know, go to Sam Goodman, click view more posts or view all posts or whatever the freaking hell it says, and scroll through and you will find some hilarious, hilarious photoshops that we've been using to promote this event. It's Hop and Operational Learning in Las Vegas, and it's going to be on October 8th and 9th. And if you want to be a part of that, if you and your team want to be a part of that, send an email to steve@hopimprovement.com. And we've still got seats available. They're moving really, 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 really quick. I'm not just saying that to say that. They are moving quick. This event will sell out or pretty much sell out well before it's time to go. It's just a couple months out and those seats are just flying. So if you want to be there, and I would encourage you to come because it's Hop and Operational Learning and it's with me and Steve Scott. It's going to be a hoot, you know that. But on top of that, you can hoot multiply that because it's going to be in Las Vegas and it's going to be 6 minutes away from the airport. So you're not going to be on the Strip. It's far easier to convince your employer to send you. I know if it's not on the Strip, but it is only about from the Strip, right? And it's on the 8th and the 9th, which I believe is a Tuesday and Wednesday. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's a Tuesday and Wednesday, which means you don't have to fly on the weekend. That's super duper nice too. And it's on a Tuesday and a Wednesday, which means that if you just have to get back to work, you can make it back in time to still do what you need to do for the rest of the week. But if you don't have to get back, it's in the middle of the week. It's on the 8th and the 9th, which means that you can stretch that into a nice long weekend. Or if you want to come in early, you can stretch it into a nice long week. You could fly in on Friday evening and have a nice weekend in Vegas and then hang out on Monday and then come to Hop and Operational Learning on Tuesday and Wednesday and then head back for the week or continue on and have another weekend in Vegas before you have to head back. I don't know. I'm just walking through what I think I'm going to do. That's probably what we're going to end up doing. So come and join us again, Steve@hopimprovement.com, Steve@hopimprovement.com to get your seats. And if you want to learn more, if you need the agenda or anything like that, you can cruise over to thehopner.com/event. And there you go. It's got some more information. You can download the agenda. It's got Steve's email over there, too. So if you want to check out some of the agenda and then email him, you can just go over there and do all that stuff. Thehopner.com/event. So with all of that really, really, really cool, fun stuff out of the way, here we go. We're going to jump right into this. I'm not coming back. We're going to cut it right to the outro music once me and Clive finish up here. The only thing that I want to tell you before we just dive right into this is, you know, we've got the Hop Nerd Sideshow happening right now. So if you're not following along with the Hop Nerd Sideshow, you should. It's everything else that's not this. Yeah. So to find that, you can find it most places that you find podcasts. Just search The Hop Nerd Sideshow, and there you go. Click follow. Make sure you give it some reviews. 5-star, again, stuff that helps keep the lights on, that doesn't cost you a dime. Leaving it those 5-star reviews, sharing it with your friends, sharing it to your social feeds helps us more than you can know. But the reason why I'm telling you this is because the second half of this interview with Clive, everything else that we talked about that's not hop and psychology and all the cool stuff that we know we get to chat with Clive about, it's going to be over there. We talked about... We did some rapid fire, yeah. So if you want to get to know Clive a little bit better, we talked a lot about guitars and music. And the whole point of the sideshow is just for everyone to get to know each other a bit better and not talk about hop and safety and improvement and learning and all the stuff that we normally talk about. So that's, I think, exactly what we did with Clive. So if you want to learn more about Clive and hear that really fun, just not hop and safety conversation, when you finish this episode up, go over to the Hop Nerd Sideshow, and you can find it on the website too. Just click podcast and, you know, scrolling down, you'll see, listen to the sideshow. You can listen to the rest of it. And if you want to leave some questions or some input on the episodes of stuff that you would like to share, if you would like to share some of your answers to the rapid fire questions that I asked Clive, when you go over to the website and you click podcast and you scroll down and click sideshow, there's a little box on that sideshow page where you can record your answers and I will feature them on the sideshow. How cool is that? Or you can leave your questions for this podcast or that podcast or anything that you want to share, anything that's on your heart or on your mind. Again, it's the internet, so sometimes it gets kind of wild and crazy and weird, but as long as it's not too wild and crazy and weird, we'll throw it on here and it'll be a ton of fun. So with all of that being said, here we go. Me, Clive Lloyd, talking about the stuff that me and Clive Lloyd talk about. Hey, here we go. I'm super selective about the people that I work with, which again, probably bad business, but good for my soul. Good for my soul. The way that I tell people all the time is that I want to work with people that I want to work with and want to work with me. And if it's not that relationship right out of the gate, so I don't bid stuff.
Yeah,
like I don't do much of that. I've done it once or twice, and every time I have, I've very much not enjoyed the process.
It's not a nice process. It's really not. And look, I 14 years ago had no intentions of scaling up. It just happened organically. You know, there were clients that I really wanted to work with, but there was only a couple of us at that time. And so organically, because there were clients we wanted to work with, especially overseas, Sam, so we needed to, you know, in order to work with the clients who were ready, you know, they were really ready, really wanting it. We wanted to service that. So that's where the growth came from. But it was certainly not an intent. It's just evolved, which has been awesome.
Yeah. Well, I would be interested to hear your take on this too, because I never set out, at least early on in this, with the idea that this was going to be a business for me.
Yeah.
Right? I was doing this stuff internally, doing this stuff working in the companies that I worked for. The podcast came along, some other stuff prior to the podcast. And then eventually it just kind of started to grow. Right. And then you're going, well, yeah, I guess I can come do that. Yeah. I guess I can come help with that. Yeah. I would love to. Let me make sure it's okay with my employer first, but I think I can come do that. And then eventually I think I woke up one day and found myself the owner of a business. Like, I don't know how that happened. It was a happy accident. It was never like I didn't wake up one day, I'm going to come up with a strategic business plan and I'm going this way and that way. And eventually you have to get to that point, right, where you're going, okay, there's certain things that I probably need to learn, certain things I probably need to start doing.
Yeah.
Right. Since this is going in that direction. What was that like for you? You said 14 years ago or so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've got a similar background there. I had no intention, really, of working in the safety space. And, we've had this discussion before. Mm-hmm. You know, my background is clinical and counseling psychology, not org psych. But yeah. Because of a background in sort of helping organizations deal with fatalities, which is work I was doing, it started making me really look at how they did safety. Because, again, I drive up to these mine sites, for example, and, you know, this big sign at the front. You know, safety is our highest priority and our goal is zero harm. and stuff like that. But Ian, you know, they brought me in to do this counselling, this very human work. And at the same time, they were looking for violators and offenders and breaches of golden rules. And I'm thinking, if it's your goal, you know, to bring your people on the journey with you, like you just wouldn't be doing that. So that's what got me started, is how I can help, you know, because I honestly believe organizations do everything they do in safety with the best of intent. I really believe that. Yeah. But it's like, we don't know what we don't know. And so when you start applying psychological principles to their language, you know, what they put on their signs, whether they're doing investigations by officers looking for who to, I mean, who doesn't love being investigated by an officer? So just tweaking their language, looking at this whole thing that if they want people, and you know, this is a no-brainer for people like yourself who work in HOP, if they want people to admit mistakes, because we all make them, principle number one, if they want to learn from errors, well, you want people to actually be free, feel safe to actually say, I stuffed up, I've lost this or I've lost that. If you don't have that, if your people are fearful with good reason of that, you cannot be a learning organization. And so that's where it all started for me. And so, you know, then I started finding models that we'd used widely in other areas of psychology fit in really, really well with culture improvement, or climate improvement, and with the ways we communicate safety, how we actually do safety. And again, just that switch from doing safety to people to doing it with them. Just that's, and so it just really took off from there. And so we still do the same thing. Essentially, we apply psychology and established research-based psychological models to helping organizations. And it's, you know, for me, like, it's a no-brainer, but I get that if you don't have that background, if you don't understand or never seen where psychology fits into, not just physical safety, but psychosocial safety, psychological safety, you wouldn't be applying it. You'd stick with the good old trusted. I mean, most organizations, at least going back 80s and 90s, they did apply psychology, but unfortunately they picked behaviorism, which for most psychologists, at least, not all, kind of died in the 1950s. We're not rats and pigeons, you know, the stick and the carrot doesn't really work.
You're telling me, Clive, that if it doesn't work, if you hook me up to those electrodes in front of the TV and every time you show me a picture of a hamburger, you zap me, I'm going to stop wanting hamburgers. That doesn't work.
I'm doomed. There, right? Only if they keep shocking you, man. You know, and again, this comes from my background in clinical psychology. My background previously was treating the addictions, right? Yeah. And a lot of people view, again, what's the problem with addiction? It's just that people take drugs, all right, the behavior. And I've often said, all right, so I could take, say, somebody who's addicted to a substance, tie them to a chair, which, by the way, Sam, I would never do. But, you know, so literally they're tied to a chair. They cannot indulge or engage in that behavior, drug-taking behavior. So I just do that. Then when I untie them, has the addiction gone? Well, no. In fact, they're going to be craving more than ever. Mm. The thing is, again, back to the principles, right? Context drives behavior. And the more I worked with people who were addicted, I got come to understand, how could you have not been an addict? Because the vast majority of them actually came from a background that was not good. It's a coping mechanism. It's a way of dealing with life, usually to fill a hole, some sort of emotional hole or spiritual, whatever it is for them. And unless you can actually help them to deal with that in better, different, healthy ways, you know, they're still going to go, it's no different in safety. It's no different in life in general. It's not the behavior. It's you know, we need to maybe, you know, look at behaviors. Some behaviors cannot continue, but you don't change the behavior by focusing on it. You actually focus on what drives the behavior. And again, this is, you know, the psychology that we use is actually totally aligned with the HOP principles.
And that's the most interesting question to me, at least, is I'm with you. I love it. I think that when you see that behavior, even if it's something that kind of makes you go, oh, right? We see those.
Yeah.
Of course we see those. We see those things in our work worlds and beyond. We see those behaviors where we go, WTF?
It
challenges our assumptions, our viewpoint of the way we view the world, the way we view our organizations. Of course, there's a bit of shock and awe sometimes when we see some of those behaviors. But I think you're spot on. I mean, I'm more interested in why that behavior makes sense, because it does.
It does. Yeah.
It makes sense.
I keep saying that, you know, behaviors are not the problem. But again, it's funny, and I'd love your what you've seen out there, Sam. We work in a similar field. I'm sure we come up against, you know, similar challenges and pushback and so forth. I think for the most part, the HOP principles are seen as self-evident truth, right? Except the one we seem to get the pushback from is blame fixes nothing. And it's an interesting one. I mean, some people are so attached to blaming, trying to suggest otherwise. It's like trying to baptize a cat. You know, it's like,
yeah. It's funny you say that, because I have a cat injury right now. The zero streak in my house broke down about 2 days ago because my daughter just got a cat. She somehow conned me into getting a cat, Clive.
Yeah.
She's already got a small herd of dogs. Right, but she got a cat, and I had this bright idea that's like, the cat needs to get to know the dog so the dog doesn't eat the cat. And it was the other way around, right? So the cat and saw the dog, and instead of eating the dog, decided to eat me. And it was a horrible time. So I can relate exactly what you're saying.
See, you didn't do a proper risk assessment there, Sam.
I know.
But again, mate,
I should have taken two.
Did you blame or did you learn? My guess might be your initial reaction was to blame the animals, right?
I think my initial reaction, and I think it's probably really relatable, is my initial reaction was, why in the hell did I think that would work?
There you go.
I went into it. This made total and perfect sense.
Yeah.
Like, I'm holding the cat. The dog's a little dog. The dog's here. I'm just going to let them see each other. not the outcome I was looking for. I discovered a new outcome along the way.
There's some weak signals there, though, right? And look, with these, you know, people who are attached to blame, I'm very gentle. I say, look, the great news is you do not have to stop blaming. We all do it. Mm-hmm. It's somebody was saying to me the other day, you know, blaming is human nature. And I think to a degree that is true. But as I also suggested, well, you know, going to the bathroom in your pants, that's human nature too. But most of us seem to grow through that one. with very little difficulty. And again, we get to, though, if we get to keep blaming for as long as we want, whenever we want. Don't expect to fix anything. And that's the point. And for me, it's understanding that, and to be gentle about it. Something happens, we get triggered. Now, we've got an energy-saving brain. It will always want us to leap to blame first. The trouble is if we then keep that process going. And another psychological phenomena here, the, you know, cognitive dissonance. And once we've formed a position of blame, we tend to follow that through because of cognitive dissonance. We don't want to backtrack and say it's almost, sometimes it's a pure defense mechanism, because if I don't blame, well, I have to take some accountability for that too. And I just, again, talk about that difference between blame and accountability, because I actually do believe in accountability. I think accountability is really important.
100%.
But you cannot have that in a genuine, authentic way with the blame stuff. Almost invariably, whatever the offending behavior was, to quote the old language, there was context behind it. And unless we actually ask those questions, what happened, we stick with blame. And often we scapegoat. And again, this is a theme in clinical psychology. We often scapegoat. Often it's an individual that we scapegoat. And often in safety, it's the person who actually had the injury. And again, well, you know all this. What we do there immediately is make it less likely that person and anybody else who's aware of what's going on will speak up in the future. So we're going backwards in terms of cultural maturity. Equally, of course, we almost totally take away the opportunity of learning. There's no need to learn if we can put blame on one person. So I think we land
on that really favorite saying in our world, if you can't fix stupid.
That's right. That's right.
That's easy. Easy peasy lemon squeezy. If I just say you can't fix stupid, then there's nothing for me to fix.
And that's,
you're just stupid. We're done.
Yeah. And that's it. Blame to me is fundamentally lazy. I get why we do it, because it is quick and easy.
I understand. Yeah. It feels good.
It feels good. And you get to keep making that choice if you wish to. I always like to give people choices. The thing is, don't expect it to fix anything. One of my tips is what I call the two choice model. I'm sure you've come across it. It's a great parenting skill too. And that is when there seems to be something there, you give people choices. You know, so your choices, you could indeed continue blaming. That is a choice you can make. And if you keep, you know, focusing on blame, what is the likely outcome? What are the likely consequences? Well, you create fear, you reduce trust, you make it less likely people. Or another choice you could make is to pause before you react. Just pause long enough to start asking broader questions. What happened? Considering the context. If we do that, what are the likely consequences? It might not be as immediately satisfying. It might take a bit of extra work and analysis, but you will help to build trust. You will learn from the incidents. Those are your choices. You go ahead.
And I think I love that. Yeah, I love that. I tend to approach it in a very similar fashion. I don't think it does us any service to go in and just bash people, bash leaders, it just doesn't work very well. It just puts people on the defensive, and they're not going to hear much of what you have to say after that.
Absolutely.
As much as I want to sometimes, and as fun as it is to go and, you know, like, this is super dumb. Why are you guys doing that doesn't work well, right? So I really like that idea with the two choice model. I think you mentioned it earlier on as we're talking about, you know, going to the bathroom in your pants is human nature too. The word that popped into my mind is maturity, right? We mature beyond those more immature approaches to things, whether that's blame or anything else. I've had conversations with multiple organizations over the past 4 or 5 months, pretty recent, that they're pretty brand new to this stuff.
Yeah.
And I like the brand new conversations.
Yeah.
They're great. They're great conversations. But especially when we get to that one, it's not that they're so defensive about it. They're not so worried about it. I think there's this fear that we're going to take away the stick.
Yeah.
In some way. And as a leader, I feel like that stick is kind of the thing. That's my thing. That's what I got. That's the thing. I got this one blunt instrument. That's how I can do this. Right. So I think it's getting them over that, understanding that information is really their one thing, right? That as a leader, I don't need very much, but really good information is something that I need. And anything that gets in the way of me getting that information is bad for me.
Absolutely. Right?
Blame gets in the way of me gaining genuine operational information, which hinders me. It just completely hobbles me. I can't make good operational decisions as a leader.
Yeah.
Right. So if blame is that thing that's standing in the way or anything else, me knowing less is not going to make this work better. It's just not going to make this work better. I always tend to share it in the sense of, pretty similar to you, is that I don't say that you just have to strip blame. I always encourage them, the starting point is move that lever to the other side of the equation.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you to move it.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying is move it. Because most of the time, most organizations that I come across, that button is right at the very beginning of the process.
Yeah.
The first question post anything unexpected happening is, who messed up and what do they deserve?
Yeah.
That's the first question. Right. You have some procedures I've seen more recently give leaders, I think it's 6 or 12 hours to decide if disciplinary action is going to be applied or not. And it almost always is, because it's the first step in the process. It's right there. If I look for someone that messed up, I'm going to find that somebody messed up, because someone has always messed up. That's just always there.
Yeah.
And it's always there. And so encouraging them to move that, to seek context first.
Yeah.
To move from who to what, at least at the beginning, and letting them know that who is always there. If you explore the deepest, darkest pits of what, and you still find that you need to come back to who, you can. Who's not going anywhere. They almost always find out that once they really explore those deep, dark recesses of what, they almost never need to come back to.
That's exactly right. And look, again, I don't think there's ever a point sort of moving blame from the workforce to leaders, right? We can blame.
It's the worst.
Or we can learn. And so I extend that to leaders. But again, if a leader who I believe are doing things to the best of their knowledge and intent, if a leader, though, say, came up through the ranks here in mining, for example, especially underground mining, they were literally taught how to lead. And that was usually at the end of a pointed finger. And, you know, it's the old cliche, if the only tool you've got is a hammer, well, every problem looks like a nail, right? So you just keep hitting it. And to be fair, I think leaders just were never provided with other tools. And again, it is reflexive to go to blame. And it's also the accountability piece. I think really in the heart of hearts, what organizations, what leaders want is an accountable organization. I do in our business.
I agree.
I want accountability. I need to be accountable to my team, and the team need to be accountable to each other and to us as a leadership team. But you don't get that through blame. It's kind of primitive, it's kind of lazy, but we all do it because there's also a physiology behind this. Again, back to the, and I hope this is not the key theme of this chat, Sam, going to the bathroom in your pants. There's a physiological thing, but for little ones, for babies, for toddlers, physiologically, they need to go, they get a signal, they go. Now, our brain is like that. You know, we get triggered by a seemingly stupid event, as you mentioned before. What the hell, stupid? We get triggered by that. Our physiology wants us to blame. It's that basic. And again, leaders, again, just need to understand that is normal. And just like we no longer go to the bathroom in our pants, we can move past that. Sorry about the kookaburras going off over here.
No, I love it. I think it's great. I'm enjoying the scenery here. This is amazing. Clive, I'm going to have to come stay with you for a little while. This looks beautiful.
Oh, mate, if you make it down under, that's a given. We'll have you here. Again, for those people who maybe missed the beginning when we just started, the reason I'm in my backyard is because the Wi-Fi in the house is terrible. And at least I've found this spot in the backyard where I do have phone signals. I'm hoping it's coming through very clearly. And so, yeah, look.
It sounds great. It sounds great on my end. I'm going to tell you, not having Wi-Fi, there are worse problems.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Until it comes.
The days that I wish I did not have Wi-Fi, Clive.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And you can even get Wi-Fi on the planes now, right? That used to be my shut-off time. But now I get Wi-Fi on planes. I can keep working. Again, that's a choice I make. I don't want to push responsibility onto the airlines. It's still a choice I make. So, look, man, these are some of the themes I'm seeing. You know, most people, most clients, if they've heard of HOP, they see most of them as self-evident truths. But you can get why some of them get stuck on, you know, blame fixes nothing. The other thing, again, some people struggling with this whole notion of HOP being, learning teams being about the topic rather than methodology. And I'm just curious, what trends are you seeing out there, Sam? Because, again, we work in similar areas. I'm sure we've come across similar themes or challenges.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there on what you just said. I think probably one of the biggest things I see is still the human error is normal conversation seems to be never ending.
Yeah,
it's never ending. And I tie that into the blame piece of it because I guess what's wild to me, though, is that some of the organizations that I'll go work with that have been on this path for a while, maybe not with me, but maybe on their own or doing whatever, they're still stuck on blame though.
Yeah.
They're still stuck there. We end up having the majority of our conversation around what does that look like in real life?
Yeah.
What does that mean in real life? And so I end up having a conversation with leaders in particular, because I spend a lot of time with mid-level leaders and frontline leaders and just various levels of leadership throughout organizations. But a lot of it is mid and frontline level leaders. The folks that I would describe as having the toughest job.
Yeah.
Just about any organization. Executives off both arms, employees off both legs.
Yeah.
Getting kind of stretched in all directions while also trying to do their job and wanting to grow in the organization. They have some ambition to grow farther and on and on and on. All the stuff that goes along with that. They really want to know how it works in real life.
Yeah.
Right. They really want to know what does that really mean? If blame doesn't fix anything, what's my move?
Yeah.
Right. What do I do here? And so I end up having this conversation a lot around this idea that we're not removing your ability to manage performance. And I always ask them that question, like, you're leaders. Yeah. And everybody's like, yeah, we're leaders. I'm like, have you ever had actual performance problems with people? And they're like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what did you do when you had those? Well, we manage them. Like I gave them an opportunity to improve that almost always do. And then they're like my best employee. And we work through that process and it usually 90% of the time it ends up with them, you know, everything's fine. They hear that blame fixes nothing. And they think, well, that means that we're going soft.
That's right.
That means that we're going soft. That means my employees can just run amok, do whatever they want.
Yeah.
Right. But I think you have to bring them back to this idea that, well, wait a second. You know, we're not talking about, this isn't a schoolhouse.
Yeah.
Right? You're not the principal. These people are adults. They're here because they want to be here. And hopefully you're here because you want to be here. Let's start the conversation there as adults, understanding that, of course, as a leader, you're going to have to manage performance problems. Sure. Yeah, of course you are. As a leader, are you going to come across those things where there are things that are completely out of bounds that happen within our work world where that pulling that lever is exactly the right move? You are going to find those things. Absolutely you are. But you're not using it as a tool to try to fix people.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sitting here having this conversation with y'all, and you guys can't fix the potholes in your parking lot, and you're going to tell me you've managed to figure out how to fix human behavior.
Yeah.
I don't think this is it, right? I don't think this is the step.
Right? No.
So I think it's a lot of the trend that I've seen for me personally is in a bit of that rambling mess that I just described, really to sum that up a bit, is walking them through what that looks like in real life. It's really that, because I think if giving them that detail is helpful. It's helpful. Those small little things that the way that I try to talk about them is very similar to the way that you described. Move that to your last option. This shouldn't be your first.
Yeah.
Explore deeply how it made sense, because it did. And if you really dive into how it made sense, you tend to develop a bit of industrial empathy somewhere along the way. You can see how it made sense. You start to understand that if it made sense to them, if I pull that lever of blame, shame, and retrain, really, the only thing that I'm doing is punishing them for something that they didn't intend to do in the first place, hoping that they don't do it again.
Yeah.
So when I say that out loud, and they say that out loud, and then they get to the end of that line and they go, well, that doesn't make a damn bit of sense. So what can we actually do to improve this? I think it's walking them through what a lot of that looks like. That's been where a lot of my conversation has been at, because I think, to maybe call this more of a, to pull that more into an overarching trend, I think what a lot of organizations do with that principle is they skip it.
Yeah,
that's probably it's hard and it's scary, and it's there. They'll have it there, and they'll have it there in some form, shape, or fashion, because many of them, as they should, take a lot of this stuff and take the intent and mold it to their own. And that's great. It's cool. Love it. Cool. But they kind of take that one and they just go,
yeah,
right. But they just don't want to have the conversations about it.
That's right.
And just, we're saving that one. We're saving that one till the end, because we're going to do the rest of them. We're going to try. We think we're going to get the rest of them really, really right. And then when we have time, we'll deal with that blame thing.
Yeah, that's it, man. And again, for me, I often help leaders, and this is not done often enough, I believe, go back to your goal. Like, have your goal as a starting place. And often that's not as simple as we think. So, you know, some people, the goal is to, hold people accountable, which is all right, but no, it's not. For me, the fundamental goal here, if we're serious about reducing harm, and harm in all its various manners, is you need your people to feel absolutely safe to speak up, to report incidents, to call in, things like that. Now, that's a fundamental goal, and I believe it should be. Well, then you need to look at what will do that for you. And for me, again, the lens of the five hot principles is a really good lens to view that through. Where this pushback, what we've become very good at, is putting the psychology behind each of those principles. Literally, what does it look like? How do you apply it? Now, that's where it starts to come good. But I put a piece on LinkedIn this morning, Sam. Just a nice, quick little story that we do share. And that was from a USA nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. What is it? The USS Carl Vinson. And again, the story was 6,000 people on that vessel, right? Dozens of planes in the air. And a young seaman actually couldn't locate one of his tools. And he just went straight to the deck boss and said, lost the tool. And between them, immediate decision to shut the whole thing down. Again, floating city, 6,000 people, dozens of planes in the air that now have to go elsewhere. And so that's a big deal. And this, I think this young seaman was about 18 or something. And I think back to myself at 18. Yeah. Was barely sober. Whole other story. But anyway, the following day, and this is where it really kicks in for me, the following day, that young seaman received a commendation. And the commendation was, again, for understanding that if you like, he made a mistake, principle one, we all make them, and felt absolutely safe in that moment to report it and take strong action. Now, again, in an environment like that, incredibly high risk, that's what you want all your people doing. Just one tool sucked up in the air intake of an incoming jet, catastrophic on a nuclear. Yeah. And again, unless we have that, forget your mantra of zero harm or whatever. That's just simply never going to happen. For me, it's just, let's get back to the fundamental goals. If we don't have a workforce and contractors, which is another topic I might raise in a moment, who feel absolutely safe to do that, you're not going to reduce the harm. You just simply can't. Humans are not built that way.
It reminds me, I'll have to go check out that piece. I have not seen it. That sounds very interesting, and I'd encourage anybody else out there to go read that. I'm going to go look that up once we get done here. It reminds me of a story in a power plant of something very similar, where a more junior operator out doing some stuff on a big natural gas power plant, right, out in the field, middle of summer. So that's kind of a big deal, right? Power plants need to run in the summer, especially in the desert. They need to run in the summer, and that's life or death in a lot of ways. You know, they've got to keep going. And so the idea of bringing a unit offline, especially a baseload unit in the middle of summer, is just unheard of. Right? Yeah. It's absolutely unheard of. Right. And this, basically what this operator, to cut that story short, came across was a hot spot in this boiler, right, in this big gas boiler, and started really investigating on their own and going, oh, okay, this can be really bad. Like, if this thing actually blows through, we're not down for a day. We're down for like the next 6 to 8 months. This could be really bad, not only for our site, for our organization, but for our community. This can be really, really, really bad. Do I just let it go, knowing the strategic importance that the company has put on this unit staying online? And not only that, but the metric, the measure that was associated with this unit being online, run, you know, here to here, it's got to run. That's how you get your bonus. If it goes offline anytime in between, you're losing money, right? As an individual, as managers, as leaders, all the way down to the pointy end, picks up the phone, makes the call, right? Talks to a plant director, the plant director. And I love this. And that plant director, I've got to say, is one of my better friends. So I'm proud of him. I've got to say that. I've got to plug that I'm proud of him. He said, because he's not on site, he's off doing something, right? He said, well, you're the expert. What do you think we should do? You're the plant operator. Yeah. I'm the junior operator. You're an operator. You know this power plant better than anybody. What do you think we should do? Take it offline. Take it offline. We're taking it offline. And the cool thing about the organization was that they went back in their little metric thing. They said, that one doesn't count because you did the right thing, which is probably the right move, right? That's not going to impact your bonus. We'll put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. And again, that's that deference to expertise, right? If we draw from high reliability. And to me, that is something we can get across to the workforce. I mentioned contractors earlier. Here's another theme, is that often we found, particularly here in mining and oil and gas construction, it's the contractor workforce that actually suffer the most injuries. Right. And indeed, deadly fatalities. And there's some reasons for that. Number one, they tend to get put on the really, really dangerous jobs that clients don't want to do.
Absolutely.
And the other thing, and my clients often say this, look, we love what you're doing in the Care Factor program. And they usually say, but, you know, we've got all these contractors. Some of them are only with us for 2 months. You know, we can't, you know, bring them into our culture. No, you can't. You don't have, culture takes forever to change anyway. What you can do, though, is through the induction process, is tell them, make sure they have evidence for the fact that here, when you're working on this site, if you notice anything that seems not okay, any weak signal, to use that language, or if you've made an error, then it is absolutely safe for you to immediately report that. You can do that. And if you do that alone, that can make a difference. But they will need evidence. As I always say in the groups, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And, you know, if you were saying safety is our highest priority, frankly, that is an extraordinary claim. You can say that, but you will need to provide extraordinary evidence that is true. And I think, again, make all the claims you like, but you'll need to back it up. You can make the claim, and I don't even think it's extraordinary if you're sincere and genuine, that on this site, when you're working here, it is absolutely safe to let us know if you've made an error. If something just seems a bit off, you can let us know. And again, you know, often they don't, with contractors, because they're, you know, often viewed as somehow inferior safety-wise, and often that is simply not the case. I know some great contractors who do a much better job than the client. But again, there's this instant belief that if a contractor makes a mistake or have an incident, you blame them. Not only that, if they have two incidents, you fire them, get another contractor in.
Yeah, and what you that's the move, right? That is the move. I've got a take. I've spent my career internal to organizations, about half and half. Half of that was working managing on the contractor side. Half of that was working internal on the client side of that equation, in businesses that relied heavily upon maintenance and construction contractors, embedded contractors, folks that would, you know, a small core group that would be at locations or within organizations, this kind of new, I don't know that it's all that new, but it's growing more and more now and across industries of this kind of staff aug kind of world that we live in, where we're going to operate it, but I'm going to hire you to maintain it. And we're going to have a small maintenance group, but you're going to do the stuff that we don't want to do, as you just said. So in that world, I can't think of a single contract, a work order that was pushed to us as contractors in the world that I came from that didn't involve like us hanging from like a wire rope balancing on
the floor. That's right.
Like it was the gnarly stuff. And we had the expertise to do it, which I tend to hope was some of the reason why they sent it to us. We did have the expertise to make that happen. But I think it's really similar to what we're just talking about with this idea of blame fixes nothing. Mm-hmm. The bring the contractors for the ride part seems to be getting passed over.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's getting passed over. I think it's getting pushed off and we're saying we're going to do that later. We're going to do that one once we get great at everything else. Then we'll think about how we bring along those damn dirty contractors on this mission as well. But I tend to see, and just from personal experience as well, contractors will almost always live up to the expectations that the client sets for them.
Yeah.
Because back to people showing up to work to do a good job, contractors do too. And they want to be there. Mm-hmm. And they want to do good work for you. And they want to be a part of your team as much as they can. And they want to be there and they want to be doing what they're doing. They live up to the expectations that's set for them. I think of keep going back into storytelling mode, but I think of an example with some scaffold builders in an industrial setting where, you know, they went up, they started to erect some scaffold, and they're amazing. God, I always nerd out when I watch scaffold builders.
Yeah.
They are insane in the best possible sense of the word. To watch them do like a hanging scaffold where they like basically rappel down and start building stuff under, it's insane to me. I love it. I could never do it. I would have a stroke if I got more than 20 feet off the ground out where they're at. It just would not happen. But they dropped something. They dropped a scaffold tube, a pole, and they dropped it in a secured area because they always secure areas. And they kept people out of there. That's why you put up red danger tape and have people down there saying, hey, don't come in here. We drop stuff sometimes. It's rare, but it happens. I would say that they failed really well. They did a really good job at failing. And I think that's something to be proud of in a sense that, you know, they did fail extremely well.
Yeah.
Where I'm going with this is in this particular organization, in the years kind of prior to them moving more towards human and organizational performance, they had the client contractor relationship that you just described.
Yeah.
You have something bad happen once. Okay. Twice. We're dragging you into the office. Three times, especially if it's three times within a little bit too much of a, then we're going to kick all of your employees off site and we're going to drag all your senior leadership team in here on site. And you're going to explain to us how this is not going to happen again. And then if you beg us for enough forgiveness, we might just let you back. If you build a big enough safety plan, a recovery plan is usually how we like to tee that up. We might let you come back. And then if it happens again, we're going to drag you to the big tower downtown and you're going to have to sit with the executives. And they would do this dance over and over. And you just knew, like you knew what you're in for if you were the contractor.
Yeah.
You knew what you're in for if you were the client. Like you just know what this is, right?
Yeah.
But that's what they'd experienced in the past. So, and what they'd experienced was that the expectation from the client was, is that if you have an employee that has something go a little bit wrong, what you do is you fire them. That's what we expect you to do. So as soon as this happened, they basically had those employees fired before the pole hit the ground.
Yeah, right.
And they're done. See you guys.
Yeah.
Now, to their credit, I think this is a really good example of how you can change that relationship really, really quickly, even when you get it kind of wrong.
Yeah.
When that information was passed along, their little incident report that says corrective action, we fired them because they're dumb. They drop stuff. Scaffold builders can't drop things. That's horrible. When that information made it to the executive team, they said, you need to undo that right now.
All right.
Who told you to do this? Well, this is what we always
what we do.
That's probably that is true. And so it was a good reflection point for the executive team too, of going, that is what we expected you to do in the past, but that's changed. And we haven't done a good job of telling you that that's changed. When stuff like this happens, we don't want you to blame and shame people. We want you to learn. And then we want you to share that with us. And it completely changed, right? Completely changed. You as a client can change those expectations. And almost always your contractors are going to do their damnedest to live up to them. Yeah. And if the expectation has been blame and shame, that's what they're going to give you. If you say, no, learn and improve, that sounds a lot better than blame and shame. That's what they're going to give you.
Yeah.
But you do have some of that power. You do have some of that power because I always hate the out. It feels a bit like an out. I know it's true, but it feels a bit like an out when I say, well, we've got a transient workforce. And,
yeah,
you know, we might not always have the same people, but I've been there. We got some of the same people.
Yeah.
They're coming back from the hall. They're coming back. I know these people.
No, and the trouble is contractors are often easier to fire, right?
Yeah.
And so, again, if there's that immediate go to blame, you can get rid of them quite easy. And again, just a very brief story, a mine, coal mine in Australia with a huge contractor workforce. At the time, the coal price was really, really high. So they're wanting to get as many tons as they can out really, really quickly, yep. Of course. Not that production would affect safety because, hey, safety is our number one priority. One of the contractors stopped the job for a legitimate safety concern. And he stopped the job. A week later, not just that one guy, but the whole contracting company he worked for, gone. Offside. Yep. And think about the remaining contractors. How likely is it that they will stop the job? And so the reason I knew about this was because that same company brought me in about 6 months later after a massive spike in serious injuries, including a fatality. And they're saying, we can't understand it. Well, let's talk.
to your point on evidence, you have to show them that it's different.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to show them that it's different. And I always just, I have a really, 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 I don't think it's a soft spot, but maybe a bit for contractors because I've been there. I know that the challenges that you face, they deserve to come along on that journey with us. They absolutely do. And I would encourage folks out there not to try to hold that out until the end, but to get them in there right now.
Absolutely.
To have that conversation with them, show them, you can tell them, but then you got to show them how that relationship is going to be a bit different.
Yeah.
And from an organization standpoint, especially as that model of work continues to grow and grow and grow and grow, many places I go, and I'm sure it's probably similar for you, Clive, is that the workforce is majority contractor.
Yeah, in many places. Yeah.
It's majority contractor. So if you're really wanting to tap into operational reality, you have to create that environment with your contractors too, because they hold the largest chunk of operational reality. They have the information.
Yeah.
It's up to you to create the environment where they can teach you about
it. Absolutely. And honestly, a lot of people, again, they have this frame, this belief that too hard, they're not here for long enough and, they'll never be part of our culture because of, they're different. You don't have to do that anyway. You just, as I said, you need to let them know from the get-go in their inductions. Around here, it's not just safety, it's an expectation and it's safe to do so. And then you will need to provide evidence of that. Because just one case, we know this from the research, one case of punishing somebody who admitted a mistake, you're done.
Done.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a senior leader to describe it to me, and his words, not mine, but I loved it and I still use it, is it's scar tissue. Yeah. It's scar tissue. It's always going to be there. It will fade. It will fade over time, but it's always going to be there. Yeah. When you have that, here is an air and here's the stick, that scar tissue is not fading. It's getting more pronounced.
Yeah.
Right? When you cut them, that scar is always going to be there. But you can help it heal over time. They're always going to remember.
Yeah.
But you can still show them that it can be a bit different. Yeah. I think with where my mind was going with the it's too hard thing, because I pick on clients all the time just because I feel like I need to and I can and it's fun. And I think it's the right thing to do, too. I genuinely think it's the right thing to do.
If you're not challenging, mate,
I don't like the it's too hard answer, because I, again, at least the industries that I've contracted in, I know from the people that we would bring in, I've done this on both the union and the non-union side of that, calling out of the hall and calling individuals directly in those worlds. There are clients that people want to go work for, and there are clients that people don't want to go work for. And I think a lot of it, yeah, there's other pieces that, yeah, it's a good job. Yeah, there's this. Yeah, there's that. But at the core of it, a lot of it has to do with stuff that we're talking about. Yeah. They treat me well. Yeah. They don't beat and punish us when we get things a bit wrong. They help us. They're there to help us. We support each other. It's that relationship. To think that I think where I'm going with this is that your transient workforce gets a whole lot less transient.
Yeah.
When they want to come back and work at your facility as a contractor.
Absolutely. It's reputational too. You know, a lot of the contractors here work for various different mining, oil, gas, construction companies. And if they've had an experience with one particular company, with that company, you do not speak up. Well, people hear about this. And so if they end up working for that client, they've already got it in their heads. Only speak up if it's absolutely essential, or try not to. The other thing that confuses this, or not confuses it, compounds it, is of course what we measure. And we've only got so much control over this. But again, when clients are bidding, or contractors are bidding for work with clients, one of the criteria, of course, is their LTI rate or their TRIFR rate. And of course, that alone, what does that tend to drive in contracting organizations? Well, don't report it unless you really need to. And I've seen some.
I've got to dig it up.
Yeah.
I've got to dig it up, Clive, because I keep saying this. It's somewhere up here, I think, in my attic somewhere. You don't go in your attic in Venus too much if you don't have to. I think there's scorpions up there. I don't want to go poking around there too much. But it's in a box. And I got a trophy for case management. While working for a contract, I got really good at it because that's the expectation. We have to make things towing that ethical line, obviously being on the right side of that, but as near to it as you can get, we need to make things not recordable, because based off of those here, TRR, same thing, based off of that total recordable incident rate determines if we get this contract or not.
Yeah.
If this other company has a point or a half point lower than us, then they're going to get the contract, even if they cost more than us.
Yeah.
Because that's where it's weighted. So we've got to keep that down no matter what. Puts that hyper focus on OSHA recordables here, that you're just spending all your time obsessed with OSHA recordables as a contractor. Because if we get that back sprain, we might not get to work here next year. And that's bad for all of us, right? That's bad for all of us.
Yeah.
It's exactly that. It incentivizes the wrong behavior.
It really
it drives us to spend their time focusing on things that aren't that important. And really, for me, just the yuck factor of it.
Yeah.
Should my role as a safety practitioner or a leader really be standing here in this doctor's office in the middle of this little town, begging this doctor to use glue or Steri-Strips instead of suturing a wound that needs sutures?
Yeah.
Where my role really should be, give them what they need.
Yeah.
They got hurt doing work for us. Make sure you take good care of them. That should be the better conversation, it feels like. Yeah. And so I've had a lot of that conversation around contractor qualifications and what that looks like. And there are some out there that are changing that. And I'm glad to see that they're changing what that looks like.
Yeah.
they're more interested in how they manage critical risk and less interested in what their total recordable incident rate is. They're more interested in their ability to learn and improve than they are in just some random number that really doesn't tell you a whole bunch. Because side tangent here, what I always tended to see, an unintended side effect of that, is that I almost always saw it. The only businesses that those pre-quals really hurt were small mom and pop local businesses.
Yeah.
Because I have 6 employees and I had a recordable, I'm done.
That's right.
I'm done. God forbid one of my employees driving a service van across town gets T-boned and dies in an automobile accident.
Yeah.
I have a fatality on my hands now.
Yeah.
I'm done for. I can't work for this organization for the next 6 years. The my business, I'm out of business.
Data is totally skewed. And again, if you look at Matthew Halliwell's research into LTI rates,
yeah.
Again, when companies see that a given contractor is 0.2 or 0.03 better than the other one, to taking that TRIF rate to decimal places is absolutely meaningless. And again,
the coin flip, right?
And so it makes no sense at all to make decisions like that based on at least percentage points of difference. It means absolutely nothing. So that's one of my bugbears at the moment. There's only so much we can control about that. It's good to hear that people are looking beyond that to critical risk management.
I'm seeing it.
Yeah.
I am seeing it. I really am seeing that quite a bit. And even into some of the larger scale solutions that a lot of these organizations use as far as software, and organizations that help them manage that, it seems like those organizations are starting to think in that direction because they're going to produce whatever the organizations need.
Sure.
Right. If it's focused on TRR, of course, I'll give you every single little way that you can slice and dice a TRR. I'll give you all that for sure. But if these clients, they're asking for different stuff now, especially as they've matured on this journey, I think that's what I would encourage folks to do, though. Spend time. I know this sounds weird to say, but spend time with your contractors.
Yeah.
I know that we get in this weird world, at least here in the U.S., and it's probably similar for you guys, where we run this weird kind of legal balancing act with our contractors, where it's like, well, I can just give you the work order, and if I direct your work too much, then I've got some liability in that, and then it gets weird. That you can still have conversations with your contractors. You can still ask them what they need from you.
And
you can
just
still
maybe
ask, show me where this isn't working for you. How can we better support you? What do you need, really?
Yeah.
What do you need? And they'll usually tell you.
Yeah. And just maybe we might even learn something from them.
Yeah. I've got to tell you, Clive, a lot of facilities that I'm in, their contract workforces, they know the equipment better than the clients do.
Yeah.
Because some of those contractors, back to the transient, not transient nature of some of these contract organizations, especially the ones that live with organizations for a long period of time, which is always funny to me because we mentioned that normal kind of dance of boot out this contractor. They've had too many recordable to bring in another one. The only thing that changes is the name on the hard hat. A lot of times the employees are the same.
Yeah.
At least the field employees, you get a new manager maybe out of that deal, or a new safety manager, a new corporate office that's now in Iowa instead of Virginia. But the people on site are the same people that are coming back to your site. Those folks, they can tell you. They have worked with your equipment, with your processes, at your site, at your mine, at your production facility, at your power. They have worked there probably longer than you have. And the cool thing about contractors is if they've not worked at your facility longer than you have, they've seen it done about a million different ways in other facilities too.
Exactly. The good and the bad.
They have this beautiful, beautiful vantage point of getting to see not only the stuff that we're talking about, how that works in other places, but different configurations of your equipment, different ways of maintaining, different ways of all of those things. On the technical and operation side of things too, tap into that. Holy crap. If we don't tap into that, we're missing out on a whole bunch of knowledge. So I've got to ask you, because I always have to ask folks since it's the last and final, any final words, anything that's on your mind right now that you just want to share with folks, or pro tips or ideas or thoughts or anything that you'd want to leave folks with as we wrap up?
Look out there right now, maybe for quite a few years, I think things are getting polarized out there. I don't think society has seemed as polarized ever in my lifetime. It's never a good thing. And again, context drives behavior. Let's look for the gray areas, hey? Not everything's black and white. let's look for the gray. Let's put that effort in to actually look at, if things are not black and white, what's in between them? And just please put a bit of effort into our thinking and not just react all the time. That's just something that's bugging me lately.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We greatly appreciate all of your support of the Hot Nerd Podcast, the Hot Nerd LLC. If you need a little bit of help bringing human and organizational performance to life, if you would like to take your efforts around learning and improving to the next level, yep, I can help with that. Head over to www.thehotnerd.com or send me an email, thehotnerd@gmail.com. Until next time, bye, everybody. Bye.